have some of the worst voting laws in the nation. I am proud that when I was counsel to Hillary, I worked with voting rights and civil rights organizations across the country to craft legislation that had Election Day registration, felon reenfranchisement, no excuse absentee balloting. The New York Times editorialized it as a gold standard for election reform. New York should be not following, we should be leading the way and helping New Yorkers exercise this most fundamental right.
Thank you, Ms. James.
Five areas. Labor. We need to protect the rights of labor, organized labor in this state of New York. At a time when they're under attack as a result of a Janus decision, it's really critically important that we support labor, and I'm so glad that the vast majority of the labor organizations in the state have endorsed my candidacy. Two, criminal justice reform, as was mentioned. Poverty should not be a crime and or mental illness, and it's really critically important that we reform our criminal justice system. As someone who went to court to seek the grand jury minutes in the aftermath of the death of Eric Garner, it's really critically important that we transform our criminal justice system, and I'm so glad that the governor of the state of New York has signed the bill with respect to prosecutorial misconduct. Corruption, as was mentioned, we need to close the LLC loophole, public financing of campaigns. We need to ban outside income, and we need term limits. And then we also obviously need to focus on tenants. As someone who's turbocharged their worst landlord list tonight in New York City, 70,000 individuals who unfortunately are homeless, we need to strengthen our tenants' laws, tenant protections in the state of New York, because too many of them, unfortunately, being harassed and abused by powerful landlord interest.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here and for a great debate. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Please remember to vote.
And that was a debate between the candidates for New York State Attorney General. Thanks to Manhattan Neighborhood Network for providing the tape.
G.C. De Palma.
Jose Nicolas de Peña.
Robert John Durrani.
Michael DeLorenzo.
David Paul DeRubio.
Jamel Legassi DeSantis.
Good evening. The anniversary of the 9/11 attacks is marked as dozens of protesters claim it was an inside job. 1 million ordered to evacuate as Hurricane Florence takes aim at the Carolinas, while voter suppression and security take center stage ahead of New York's Democratic primary. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Tuesday, September 11th, 2018. Today marks the 17th anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the United States. At 8:45 a.m. on that clear Tuesday morning, American Airlines Flight 11, a Boeing 767 loaded with 20,000 gallons of jet fuel, crashed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York City. 18 minutes after the first plane hit, as thousands of people attempted to evacuate the building, a second Boeing 767, United Airlines Flight 175, appeared out of the sky, turned sharply toward the World Trade Center, and sliced into the South Tower near the 60th floor. Meanwhile, American Airlines Flight 77 had been hijacked and was crashed into the Pentagon at 9:37 a.m. United Airlines Flight 93 was hijacked moments later, and after a heroic fight for control of the plane, crashed at 10:03 in a field in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. 2,996 people were killed in the attacks and more than 6,000 were injured. Deaths included 265 on the four planes, including the hijackers, 2,606 in the World Trade Center and in the surrounding area, and 125 at the Pentagon.
Oh, we have breaking news. It looks like a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. There is a huge explosion and fire at the top of the World Trade Center. This is a live broadcast at 8:52 in the morning. We have no story right now as to the cause, if it's an accident or was intentional, but it looks like the top half of both towers are absolutely in flames. This is a huge disaster. Be careful. Stay out of the lower Manhattan area. We're going to get headlines on this story.
Live on-air reporting from the studios of WBAI, featuring former morning show host Marjorie Moore, studio guest Dana Beal, and this reporter, joined by news director Santiago Nieves, Santiago, and news reporter Eric Williams, and other WBAI hosts and engineers. The studios of this radio station, WBAI, was at the time located on Wall Street, less than a mile away. What began as a day when the biggest story was the Democratic Party primary election for mayor of New York City became the beginning of a new era for the United States and the world. The primary was postponed. Today, a group of about 50 activists held a vigil near the memorial as the names of the victims were read. They claim that the government has never told the truth about what really happened on 9/11. The protesters joined a significant number of people who have never accepted the government's story. A spokesperson for the group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth is Albert Lucientis. According to Lucientis, the violence of the explosions that took down the towers can only be explained if the explosives if explosives had been placed in the buildings beforehand. His group's controversial claim is that the buildings were taken down as part of a conspiracy to justify the subsequent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
We're just looking for a legitimate look at this evidence. Until this is properly addressed, it's never going to heal. It's never going to go away. And the evidence is that overwhelming. The problem is that there's so much nonsense thrown at 9/11 that has nothing to do with 9/11 truth, like no planes claims or, you know, all this anti-Semitic stuff. None of that has anything to do with 9/11 truth. 9/11 truth is just about the forensic evidence that we have no way to explain other than through the use of explosives.
Lucientis was speaking near the site of a building called 7 World Trade Center that collapsed at about 5:20 p.m. He says 7 World Trade Center, which was subsequently rebuilt, has generated the most evidence of an outside hand in the destruction. He says the buildings were demolished as if it was planned and controlled.
No building in the history of engineering has ever exhibited the characteristics of a demolition, of an imploded building like that, and not been a controlled demolition. Yet on Building 7, they want us to believe that it was office fires that brought them down.
A report by the National Institute of Standards and Technology was released in 2008 that claimed 7 World Trade Center fell because of uncontrolled fires and the lack of water to put them out. The report added that diesel fuel stored in the building by government agencies did not contribute to the fall of the building. 7 World Trade Center had been the location of Mayor Giuliani's emergency command center. As the building fell around him, it's reported that Giuliani and his security detail barely got out alive. In more national news, more than 1 million people have been ordered to move inland to get out of the way of Hurricane Florence. The hair-raising storm is taking dead aim at the Carolinas with 130-mile-an-hour winds and heavy rains. The hurricane is expected to drop up to 2 feet of rain that could cause flooding and wreak environmental havoc. Famous for its hog farms, which generate massive lakes of waste, the rain could wash the toxic gook into North Carolina waterways. Governor Roy Cooper called Florence life-threatening, adding that wind and waves could bring devastation like you've never seen before. Donald Trump declared a state of emergency for North and South Carolina and said today that the government was absolutely, totally prepared for Florence. The last big hurricane to hit the area in 1954 was Hazel. It destroyed 15,000 buildings and caused 19 deaths. In political news, allies of President Trump told Axios he is expected to order the government to declassify government documents covering the surveillance of Trump campaign advisor Carter Page and the investigative activities of senior Justice Department lawyer Bruce Orr. According to the Axios report, Republicans on the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees allege that Orr, a previously little-known figure, played an improper role between the Justice Department, British spy Christopher Steele, and Fusion GPS. Fusion GPS is the Democratic Party-funded opposition research firm that produced the Trump Russia dossier. The document claims misconduct between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. But some investigators say that there may be much more to Trump's action than punishing Orr, whose wife worked for Fusion GPS. Orr has made a career of prosecuting Russian organized crime figures, in particular a Russian citizen, Semyon Mogilevich, known as the Brainy Don of the Russian mob, who had been indicted in the United States on charges of defrauding a Philadelphia company of $150 million. It's known that Mogilevich, who lives openly in Moscow, had business dealings in the United States for decades, including in the New York area. He is also associated with another reputed crime figure, Felix Sater, who once rented an office in Trump Tower. Both were involved in financing the Trump Soho Hotel in Manhattan. Economist James Henry has written extensively on Trump's organized crime connections. He says that if Trump takes down Bruce Orr, it will gut out the heart of the Department of Justice organized crime investigation into those Russians most closely implicated in the Trump organization.
Much of what we've learned about Mueller so far has had to do with the case involving, you know, sort of either obstruction of justice or collusion with respect to the 2016 election. You know, all of the financial crimes that really accounted for Trump's sort of rise from after 2000 have been much less, I would say, the focus of this investigation, so far as we know. In principle, there's an awful lot to look at, and I've written about it, a number of other people have written about it. And so the sort of the kind of hardcore traditional financial crimes like securities fraud, concealment fraud, not telling your investors that you're partnered up with convicted felons like Felix Sater, money laundering. We have cases involving Sater and Giuliani's law firm setting up companies in the Netherlands. 2007 and then 2014, you know, using these connections to invest in the Trump Soho. There's a lot to look at here that's just good old-fashioned financial crime. And Trump, you know, faces some interesting issues. If he loses the presidency in 2020, he'll be out of office, and the statute of limitations on some of these financial crimes won't really run out until at the earliest 2020, because they're, you know, at least 10 years long and they can be extended. So I think that he's kind of concerned about undermining the FBI's ability to really investigate this and getting rid of some of the knowledge centers of expertise within the Bureau and the Justice Department that have to do with white crime.
Henry says the other Trump administration officials may have something to hide as well, including former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani.
Have identified other players in the administration like Giuliani as having also been involved in some strange deals with Ukrainian oligarchs and with the Kazakhstan oligarchs. Giuliani actually tried to raise money for his 2008 failed presidential campaign from in Kazakhstan, where his law firm, Bracewell, at that time had an office. So, you know, there's, I think, an awful lot for Trump to be concerned about and for his immediate circle to be concerned about. And that's part of the motivation for going after, I think, this particular guy and basically the others around him.
Economist and investigative reporter James Henry. He says that the second trial of Trump campaign official James Manafort, who once advised pro-Russian officials in Ukraine, may provide further transparency into ties between Trump and the mob. In New York, while most elections in the United States occur on Tuesday, this year a confluence of holidays convinced election officials to move the important vote to Thursday, September 13th. Elections and their security have been on the minds of commentators, reporters, and prosecutors since the disputed 2001 presidential election that put George W. Bush in the White House over a handful of ballots cast in Florida. Last month, Deputy Attorney General Ron Rosenstein announced indictments of 12 alleged Russian military intelligence, or GRU, agents for hacking the 2016 presidential election.
Russian GRU officers hacked the website of a state election board and stole information about 500,000 voters. They also hacked into computers of a company that supplied software used to verify voter registration information. They targeted state and local officials responsible for administering elections, and they sent spear phishing emails to people involved in administering elections, including attaching malicious software.
Florida Senator Bill Nelson, in a tough re-election campaign, stated that classified information says the Russians are at it again, trying to hack into the nation's election system and gain access to voter information. Florida officials and others have denied Nelson's claims. Common Cause New York is a good government advocacy group that makes recommendations for expanding voter opportunities. Executive Director Susan Lerner says that New York was probably not one of the states hacked, in part, she says, because the New York system has a paper backup.
One of the things I can say is that there doesn't seem to be an indication that among the states that were targeted that in 2016, New York was one of the states where there was any successful attempt to hack into the election system. I know people have great nostalgia and fondness for the old lever machines, but the strength of our current system here in New York is that our system is paper-based, and you can't get to the paper ballot through the computer. There are various checks I know that this state actually is working quite hard in tandem with the appropriate people at the federal level to ensure the cybersecurity of our elections. But the real fallback is the paper ballots. If there is any kind of question, we've got the actual ballots. They can be recounted.
But she adds New York does have problems with voter suppression that discourages voter turnout.
We have instances on Long Island. There are several instances where Latino voters were out and out discriminated against in village or town elections. The Department of Justice, the AG, came in one village. They reran the election because the suppression was so extreme. We've had perennial problem. Well, they basically kept people from voting. They took people off the rolls. They basically or they intimidated people. They placed police outside. They basically made it clear that people who looked to be Latino were not welcome. And we have perennial problems in various upstate counties where students are prohibited, are prevented from either registering or given a hard time when they come to vote. So don't assume everything is okay. So in terms of outright voter suppression, occasionally we see that. But we have what I call soft voter suppression, covert voter suppression. And that is elections that are very badly run, voter rolls that are not well maintained, where people are arbitrarily removed off the voter rolls, or people who have moved or deceased remain on the voter rolls. And here in New York City in particular, in busy elections, in busy polling places, astronomically long lines that really discourage people from voting, particularly working people whose time is very precious. It's one of the reasons why we're working so hard to get the state to adopt early voting.
Voter suppression is a strategy designed to influence the outcome of an election by discouraging or preventing specific groups of people from voting. For example, some states have required onerous registration deadlines and intrusive ID systems. Some officials express antipathy to Latinos and other ethnic groups, as some states have purged voter rolls. Lerner says the source of the problem is New York's antiquated approach to running elections.
The main antidote for the problems, I believe, is bringing our election administration here in New York up to the 21st century, adopting early voting, same-day voter registration, automatic voter registration, restoring formally, statutorily reforming the rights of people who are on parole to vote, and also pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds, and adopting a nonpartisan election administration. That is adequately funded to get the job done.
According to Lerner, the solution to New York's voting problems lies with the state government in Albany and, by extension, its executive, the governor. Lerner spoke at length about what is unique about this midterm primary election, the role of the primary in New York politics, and ideas for improving access to the polls. We include her remarks, which center on the unusual situation of state Senate seats that have become competitive this year.
Well, what's happening is that we have an unusually large number of primaries for the state Senate. New York famously is a state that returns incumbents to office at an extraordinarily high rate. And therefore, it's unusual for there to be effective challenges to sitting senators or assembly members. This cycle, we have, I think it's a total of 17 or 18 challenged primaries. Of those, one is a Republican primary in Senate District 15. In Senate District 11 and 34, there are both Democratic and Republican primaries, and every place else, they're Democratic primaries. One thing that we've seen at Common Cause New York, and we're not unusual, is an extraordinary increase in number of people who want to become civically and politically engaged. And that is the silver lining to the sad situation that we see at the federal level. People who, and I heard this from people who become very, very active over and over again, I thought everything was okay. I didn't feel like I needed to pay much attention to politics. There's a lot going on in my life. I have young kids, or I'm, you know, working very hard at the stage of my career where I need to focus on that. But the November 2016 election was a wake-up call, and I realized I can't count on anybody else. I have to get involved myself.
How about the other direction? Has there been any sort? Because I've been in upstate New York, and there's a strong, you just go to the Delaware County Fair, and there's a strong pro-Trump. I mean, they're selling Confederate flags, and people are protesting. The local people are protesting it, but still it's happening.
Absolutely. You may remember in April 2016, around the presidential primary, that was a time when people became aware of the closed primary system here in New York State, which means that you have to be registered for in the party whose primary you want to vote in far in advance of the actual primary. And the outrage was across the political spectrum. There were as many potential Trump voters who were infuriated that they could not vote in the Republican primary as there were people who wanted to vote in the Democratic primary. And if you talk to upstate legislators, they will tell you that their district offices were fielding outraged calls from people from both the left and the right in April of 2016 because they wanted to vote in the party primary.
And the state of Wisconsin's had open primary voting for 100 years, it seems.
Well, you know, there are a lot of different ways to do it. One way that we could do it is to have a sensible deadline for changing our party registration. Our party registration deadline is now in the fall of the year prior to the primary. That's absurd. There is no other state that has that crazy or objectionable of a deadline. We could make it just the regular registration deadline. It would be the same as the deadline to change your party registration, which is the way it is in most places.
Why is that so important?
It really turns people off to find that they can't vote in the primary. And in parts of our state, if you don't vote in the primary, you basically don't really have a strong voice in deciding who your representative is. The truth of the matter is that in New York City, for many of our districts, both at the city council level and at the state legislative level, the person who is going to be the next representative for you in either legislative body is chosen primarily at the primary level. We are a predominantly Democratic city. It's really hard to find a lot of Republicans in central Brooklyn or in parts of the Bronx or Queens or Manhattan. And so with a preponderance of Democratic registrants, anybody who successfully gains the Democratic nomination is likely to be the next city council member or state senator or state assembly member.
Mm-hmm. I see. Right. So we know that in New York, it's been a long history of that. How about third parties? Do they have anything to, you know, the Working Families Party, independents, conservatives, liberals?
Well, at the primary level, the turnout is so appallingly low that a third party that actually wants to work at being something other than a fusion party can have an impact.
What is the effect? What would the effect have been in 2016 if Republicans could have voted in the Democratic primary for president of the United States? Would Hillary Clinton might have lost? Bernie Sanders might have won?
Well, it's impossible to tell. I think, I can't speculate on that. But given the number of people who are angry that they couldn't vote in the Republican primary, I would be surprised if there'd be a lot of switchover. You know, the knock against being able, the putative argument against having a rational date by which to change your party registration is that you would have widespread party raiding. But as you point out, we have so many states across the union who either have open primaries or sensible deadlines to change your party registration, and raiding is very, very rare.
I remember I was here in 2001, right? And today was
yes,
a primary day.
Correct.
It was supposed to be a primary day. I was
right.
Everybody was expecting to vote when we came in the morning, and they actually canceled the primary.
Rescheduled it.
Right. Is there some connection? It's on Thursday this time.
Has nothing to do with the 9/11 anniversary. It has to do with the fact that today is the second day of Rosh Hashanah, which is an extremely important Jewish holiday. Normally, with that kind of conflict, you would expect that the election would be pushed back to the next Tuesday. But next Tuesday is the evening is the beginning of Yom Kippur, which, if anything, is an even more important Jewish holiday. So the timing here has run up into the very important Jewish holidays where there is no flexibility. And I think they were concerned to hold the election on the day after Labor Day, that there would be even lower turnout than usual.
I see. Is there a high turnout expected in New York? I mean, all around the country there is, but...
It's impossible to tell. We provide so little information to voters regarding election dates. And remember, we are the only state in the union that has two legislative primaries. Our state can't get its act together to have one primary date for congressional primaries and state legislative primaries. So the voters get socked twice with the cost of running two unnecessary primaries instead of the legislature consolidating them.
Now let's get back just for a minute to the state senate, because mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself and your organization partisan in the sense of you want to see progressive change?
Well, no.
And finally, that was Susan Lerner. She's the executive director of Common Cause New York, the Good Government Advocacy Group. She spoke with WBAI earlier today. And finally, in something approaching good news, two former enemy nations in the contentious Horn of Africa officially opened borders where a bloody war had kept them divided for decades. Ethiopia and Eritrea announced that troops would be removed from both sides of the border as emotional residents embraced after years of separation. People of the Tigray region between the two countries danced as flag-draped camels walked by. The two bitter rivals, who share close cultural ties, made a stunning reconciliation weeks after a new reformist government took power in Addis Ababa. Reports say mine-cleaning operations have begun along the border. Ethiopia's reformist Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said that the last 5 months have brought hope and reconciliation to the two nations. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 11th, 2018. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.
It's been said that an image is worth a thousand words. A concept implying that a single visual element can replace a multitude of descriptive factors, that one image can carry meaning and definition far more adequately than any verbal or written description. In the case of our own definitions, that is, as Native American people, why have we been reduced to a single word, a single silhouette? Red skin. One word, two syllables. Labeled in many dictionaries as a noun, dated or offensive, and simply defined, an American Indian.
Sego, this is John Cain. Join me for a free screening of More Than a Word, Thursday, September 27th, 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue, right here in Brooklyn, New York.
Celebrate We the World and Good News Planet's 20th anniversary Interdependence Day Peace Party, a conscious, spiritual, and peace community gathering with special presenters that takes place during 11 days of global unity with inspirational talks, live performances, and video presentations. That's Wednesday, September 12th from 6:30 p.m. sharp to 9:30 p.m. at the Church of the Village. 201 West 13th Street, corner of 7th Avenue in New York City. Doors open at 6 p.m. For tickets and info, go to www.we.net/20years. That's using the number 20. We.net/20years. Or call 212-222-5432. That's 212-222-5432.
Hey Maya, guess what? Kylie Jenner's new lip kit is out.
Mercedes, are you really gonna spend your money on that garbage?
It's not garbage. She finally released a color I've been looking for, ginger.
Mercedes, you can do so much more.
Like what?
You can donate it to WBAI and become a BAI buddy.
What's a BAI buddy?
A BAI buddy is someone who signs up to make a monthly donation to WBAI. Once you join, you'll receive a BAI buddy card and a free tote bag. The BAI buddy card allows you to become eligible for on-air giveaways and receive discounts at local shops, museums, and venues. And that's not even the best part. You can get all of this and more by donating as little as $10 a month.
That sounds amazing. I want to become a BAI buddy. How can I join?
You can sign up at WBAI.org.
WBAI.org? Got it. Thanks. And you're right, I can do a lot.